The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. And so, in 1981, I was younger than I am now, and I was living at a Buddhist monastery. I had decided not to go to graduate school, which I'd been accepted to. And I was wondering what to do with my life. And the thing that I was most interested in had to do with the practice of Buddhism. And then in a moment, a particular moment, I knew that I wanted to spend my life making a difference in the world, somehow addressing and meeting the suffering in the world with teaching Buddhism. I didn't actually think I'd be a teacher too much. Back then I was a Zen monk or a Zen practitioner. And I thought that I would have a key to a small Zen meditation hut someplace in the city. And my job was to open the door so people can come and sit, and I would sit with them. But I wanted to somehow present the practice opportunities because I felt very confident that, as far as I knew, the best way to address human suffering was through this practice. And I wanted to try to find some way to alleviate suffering for individuals, and I wanted to make this a better world for all of us. That's what I wanted my life to be about. And the reason I chose Buddhism was that, from what I knew at that time, that was the only thing I knew that really touched some of the deepest places of suffering in the human heart, some of the deepest places of holding and attachment to self. And so that set my life in a certain direction. My life is still dedicated to that, still interested in that, just as much as it was back then. And so, I've given a lot of thought to this topic of how do we make this world a better place. And over these years, one of the things that I've done is been involved or was recruited for various efforts in different Buddhist centers and elsewhere to be involved with what they called ethics. To be involved in situations where people were in conflict with each other, situations where someone had hurt someone else, or a situation where someone had violated a principle that the different institutions had. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how do you address these kinds of issues, and how do you do it from this dharmic point of view from Buddhism? How do you approach conflict in a way that doesn't side with one side, but how do you approach conflict in a way that tries to consider what's best for everyone involved, so much that everyone involved feels like they're being supported and helped and understand what's going on? How do we understand, there's all these different issues. And so slowly I've been kind of, studying this area of what in the West is called ethics. You don't have to do too much ethics if you just sit and meditate, because it's all kind of negotiated with your own heart, and finding your freedom and working through the different attachments, working through the ways which we're in conflict with ourselves or the ways we hurt ourselves. And so you kind of do this deep inner work. But then most of us just don't sit with our eyes closed meditating all day. At some point we have to talk to those other people and interact. There's a story of Suzuki Roshi, founder of San Francisco Zen Center, who said that when he looked around the meditation hall and saw everyone sitting, He thought everyone, he saw everyone as a Buddha. That was nice. And then he said, but then you open your mouths. And then they're not quite Buddha-ish anymore. So one of the things I would like to share today with you is some of the things I've learned about this field of ethics, about conflict, and how do we make moral choices, how do we decide how to find our way in the wider world. And I want to do that a little bit in the relationship to what in Buddhism is called the five precepts. These are sometimes considered the fundamental ethical precepts for lay people. There are five of them. And not to kill, not to kind of in a simple way of saying it, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to intoxicate oneself. A little bit more nuanced, it says not to harm living beings, which is understood to mean not to kill, not to take what is not given, which is a little bit higher bar to live by than simply don't steal. If it's not, haven't been offered, don't take it. And then no sexual misconduct, no lying. There's a little bit nuanced what it says about intoxicants. And there's some debate whether the rule is don't drink alcohol and take drugs to the point of intoxication, or don't drink and take them at all. So it's a little bit nuanced, a little bit. So that's a whole topic. But these five are very important, and they're very cherished in this Theravadan Buddhist tradition. They're held up in high esteem and high value, and the way that I couldn't understand when I first entered into this tradition, how valuable they are. But I've come to appreciate and love these five precepts quite a bit. So it's in relationship to those I'm going to talk about, principles of ethics. And people come into conflict with each other around their ethics, around their decision-making and how they make choices about how to live their lives, how they vote, what they do with their time and what they buy, and all kinds of things. They have different points of view, their politics and everything. And many people feel that their way is right. And so how do you have a conversation with people? How do you find your way with it? So in order to become much more sensitive and aware of how we make choices, how we're in conversation with people around ethics and behavior and conduct of right and wrong, people who study ethics have come up with the idea that there are four basic approaches for making ethical choices that people make. And different people, and no one does only one. Different circumstances, people do different ones. Different ones are more amenable to certain situations than other situations, or for some reason they evoke different approaches in us. But when sometimes people are in conflict with each other, it's because they're coming from a different ethical approach. They have a different kind of attitude of how they're understanding it. And so they both think that they're ethically right, but somehow they're missing each other or in conflict because of the differences of how they understand the situation. So I thought it might be interesting to let you tell you about these four approaches, and then maybe show how these four approaches can be applied to these five precepts. And you can see how people can live by the precepts, these five basic precepts, from very different perspectives or orientations towards them, or reasons for why they want to live this way. So the four ethical approaches, the first is based on principle. So there are principles that to be followed, and it's very clear. Like, so there's the golden rule. That's the principle. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. And so that's a principle, and people can live that way, follow that principle. The precepts are principles. So like, don't kill. And just that, the Buddha said that, so that's good enough for me. So I'm not going to kill. That's the, you know, no matter what. The precepts can be taken as principles. The problem with principles is that there are many principles people live by. And some of them, before I say the problems, and some of them are deeply enshrined now in our modern secular culture because we have professional ethics. that are based, mostly principle-based. And so we have in hospital ethics, where there's principles that patients have autonomy. There's four major basic principles in hospital ethics, medical ethics, that patients have autonomy. Autonomy, it's called beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. So autonomy means that the patient has complete autonomy to make their own choices. Beneficence means you want to benefit people. Non-maleficence means you want to do non-harm. And then justice, and especially when they talk about it a lot in the medical profession, has a lot to do with fairness, fair allocation of resources and all that. So these are principles that they try to make very sometimes very complicated decisions about. Decisions they have to do often with life and death issues. How long do you keep someone on life support? And who makes a choice to take someone off life support? The doctors don't want to have to do that themselves. How do you find your way? But they have these basic principles that they operate under, and with those they find their way and try to work with everyone. In psychotherapy and helping professions, there are very clear principles that people have to follow, or they lose their license. There's, you know, no question about it. There are certain principles that are expected in the world of business. This is how it should be. So principles are a really important part of our culture. But one of the problems with principles is that they don't take consequences into account. So applying a principle in some situations might be great, but in other situations it might be the wrong thing. It might cause more harm than good. So the second approach for ethics is to approach it from the point of view of consequences. What are the consequences of the actions? What's the results going to be? And Buddhism is primarily, the teaching of early Buddhism is primarily consequentialist approach to ethical decisions. And the primary, kind of simplest way of saying that is do no harm. Avoid causing harm and eliminate all forms of harm. So those are consequentialist because that's something you're going to do in the future. It's a goal. It's a result that you want to have. You could say it looks like a principle, but because it has to do with something in the future that you're trying to attain rather than a particular idea, this is how you're supposed to live, like very narrow kind of principle. But consequentialism has a lot to do with, you know, what a lot of people in ethical terms look to see what brings benefit, what does good in the world. Unfortunately, consequentialists can be very egotistical. What's best for me? Or what's best for my family? What's best for my group of people? What's best for my country? And so it can be very carefully bounded, and then others don't matter. Or it can be the maximum good for everyone involved. But once you get into questions of the maximum good for everyone, then some people get into big quandaries of what to do. It can be very painful. Like in medical ethics, when you have a limited amount of resources and you want to do the maximum good for everyone, does that mean that you have to allow some people to die because it's just too expensive to keep them alive, and those resources could be used to keep a lot of other people happy and going well or something? And so people are kind of trying to work these things, these questions out. The third approach is for making ethical decisions is virtue, called virtue ethics. And this is where what guides people is it virtuous? And is it a certain kind of understood, a certain kind of not just principles, but certain dispositions or elements of human character that are upheld as being very valuable? And this is what you know. So someone, in Buddhism, we put a lot of emphasis on generosity. Generosity is a virtue, and so you do the things that you do the things that's generous, or compassion is a virtue. You do things that are compassionate, and generally, the virtue ethics has to do with there's an ideal way of doing things, and you follow the ideal. And so, what would Buddha do? Is the question. just figure out what the Buddha would do. Or you have someone you really respect a lot, and you do what that person would do that, so I'll do it that way too, because that's the ideal, that's the virtuous way of doing it. And people who take a lot of refuge in the idea of integrity are taking refuge in virtue ethics. I'm going to check in with my integrity and do what's integrous. And that has to do with doing something with what's right for your inner disposition, as opposed to the right by principle or right by what the consequence is going to be out there. The fourth approach of ethics is called moral sentiment. And that means that you make ethical decisions based on how it feels for you. It feels good. Or it's just disgusting. That's become popular in the news lately, the idea that things are disgusting. But that's considered to be a very fundamental, almost basic, human ethical instinct towards purity and the impure and things like that. A certain emotional relationship to things like fairness as opposed to a principle of fairness. Beauty, all kinds of things that inspire a certain kind of emotional feeling. The difficulty with people doing ethical choices based on what they feel is they can't explain why, except they feel that way. And so it's very hard to have a conversation. It's very hard to unpack what's going on. It's very hard to then be in conversation with people of other reasons for doing things that may be different than the one who has moral sentiment. It's difficult to have a conversation. It's just like a kind of a conversation stopper. I just feel like it. And then, what are you supposed to do? And so these are four approaches that are done. So now, in terms of the Buddhist precepts, not killing, some people will take it as a principle. It comes from the Buddha. This is what Buddhism says. I'm a Buddhist, therefore this is what I have to do, and no question about it. And there are times where I would like to champion this principle approach. And what comes to mind right now, we don't have it anymore now, but when I was younger, we had the draft, a conscription. And so I would spend a lot of time thinking about what I was going to do if I got drafted, because I was of the draftable age. And that was pretty clear that I was either going to get 30 pounds of dental braces, or something that just made me undesirable in the military, or declare I was a conscientious objector. It's very hard to be a conscientious objector if you tell the draft board, "Oh, I don't feel like going to war." it's kind of that bothers me, and you kind of have to come by principle for the most part. So this goes against my principles. I'm a Buddhist. Buddhism, we have a principle that you don't kill, and therefore, I'm bound by that principle. That makes it clear, and I think that kind of, in that kind of situation, maybe it works better than other approaches. But then some people, it's not principle-based that they don't kill. Some people hear this precept, don't kill, so they give thought to it, they reflect on it, but they're motivated not by the principle, but they're motivated by the consequence. They realize that a lot of harm is caused when people get killed. Certainly the person who's gotten killed has been harmed. Maybe their friends and family have been harmed. And, most people in our society generally think that killing people is not a good idea. But as a society, society kills people, right? We have capital punishment, and we go to war. So decisions are made. And sometimes those decisions are based on consequentialism, that there's a greater good for society, for us, if we are involved in killing those people over there. And so that justifies some people's minds that this is okay because it's worse if we don't, and this is better. So that's a consequentialist attitude. And some people who don't want to follow the first precept of not killing will understand that how much harm is caused in killing human beings and maybe animals as well. I'm just really struck by the legacy of wars of the 20th century. Going back, to 100 years, that what people went through still ripples down painfully into families today. What happened in World War II ripples powerfully into families to this day. I have two children who were born. One was born in 1998. One was born in 2002. So decades after World War II. But their grandparents went through the concentration camps. And they know it. At least the older one knows it. And, it's in his, now in his family history, in his memory, in his contact with his beloved grandparents and their experiences. My older son interviewed my grandfather before he died and got all these stories and filmed it and all this. It was quite something when he was 14 or 15. And my son now is 21. So, you know, maybe he'll live another 50 years or more, I hope. And the legacy of World War II will continue in him for all those decades in some way or other. So the ripple effect of going out and out and out of war, even with a consequentialist calculation, if we take into account, you know, the ripple and the way it expands outward, is it ever worth it just for a short-term gain? So that's one reason why some people will abide by the first precept, because of the consequences are just not worth it. The third approach with the first precept is that of virtue. And some people will feel that somehow that there's a sense of inner goodness, a purity, some sense of compassion, something that's operating in their heart that really is vibrating and strong, and they just can't violate it. That just seems to carry the day for them. And it just seems that goodness is, or that integrity is where they want to come from and what they want to do. It doesn't matter what the consequences are. It doesn't matter if it's a principle or not. It doesn't matter if the Buddha came back and said, you know that principle about the first precept? I was all wrong about that. It doesn't matter because they've tapped into, or they have in them, certain qualities or dispositions or character that are so strong that this is what they base their life on. And so I'm going to follow the first precept because of the compassion that I feel. I'm going to follow because of the purity I feel. For me, when I started doing this practice of Vipassana, I did my first retreat was 10 weeks long, long retreat. And I sat, I didn't know what to expect sitting it. But one of the big impacts of that retreat was, in the course of it, I opened up, I discovered, I found, something shifted, that I discovered an inner feeling of purity that I'd never experienced in my life before. And there's a little bit of surprise for me because the word purity was a word that I kind of didn't like. And then to feel it, you know, then I couldn't, you know, it was my own then. It wasn't just an idea out there and other people who were a little bit uptight about purity. It has this beautiful feeling of cleanliness and openness and freedom that seemed to, you know, really kind of course through my body. And so that would be kind of related to virtue. And I felt that this is good. This is like one of the best things going. And then I could see that as I, like lust arose or anger arose or different resentment arose, these different things arose, that I could feel how it kind of violated or did violence to that sense of purity or darkened it or tore it or something. And I felt like, no, I don't want to, I shouldn't do that. I want to stay true to this purity. This seems like the best place to be or the right place to be. It had a rightness to it. And so I'm not going to kill because that violates, you know, violent to this sense of virtue or character that I had now. So that would be kind of a virtue approach to the first precept. The problem with a virtue approach is that sometimes maybe the consequences are so dire that you don't just sit there and stay that way. Maybe sometimes you want to sacrifice purity or goodness, if you know, if you know, if someone is going to kill your entire family, what do you do? And I'm not going to answer that question. I hope I never have to answer that question. I don't want to answer that question. But, you know, some people would clearly make certain choices then, that maybe in that circumstances, their purity doesn't count. Or what about their country? What if they go to war? What if, you know, what if someone goes to war against your country and lands on Baker Beach? What do you do? So all these questions, you know, what do we do? How do these things come into, how do they balance out? And then finally, moral sentiment, I suppose, with the first precept would be, it just doesn't feel right to go around killing people. You know, it just doesn't feel right to live in a society where that is. It just kind of bothers me. It feels really yucky. And so that would be the reason, the basis for it. Now, someone could have all four approaches in different balance. Someone could have them in different ways so that they end up in conflict with other people. Someone who is going to be purely virtue-based or principle-based might be in conflict with someone who's consequentialist-based, who really makes different choices and balances his different ways. They might say, oh, yes, I agree not to kill. But there are times when it's appropriate because of the great difference between the harm and the benefit can come. And if we go to war, that's going to save a lot of problems. And it's, you know, or capital punishment is needed because the principle of justice needs to be, you know, needs to be upheld. And someone else's consequentialist will say, yes, but that perpetuates a society that thinks it's okay to kill, and it ripples out into the wider society and supports a violent society, they'll say. So people have different arguments and different ideas, but it has a lot to do with where they're based on these four. So, same thing with the second precept of not to steal. It can just be a principle, and some people hold to it tightly. Some people will look at the consequences. Some people will look at the virtue around it. Some people will look at, you know, what they feel. What's interesting is that there's an idea of moral development over time, that people can evolve ethically over time. And generally, the idea is that young children tend to be more principle-based. And it's kind of, you know, they don't have maybe a sophisticated mind, or they need to have a lot of order and clarity. And so having things be principle-based works really well. And that's kind of, and then as people grow older, and if they grow in a normal kind of maturing way, then different ones of these come into play. And so we see this in Buddhist practice as well, that people who begin with principle-based approach, which some teachers, that's what they'll tell you. You know, when you first come to Buddhist practice, just follow these principles, follow the precepts. If you come on retreat, that's what we kind of tell you. These are the rules, these, you know, the precepts. And if someone decided to break one of the precepts on the retreat, they wouldn't stay at the retreat probably. You know, that's you know, it's kind of violates the container and the safety that people have. So we follow it there, kind of a principle-based approach. But as people develop, they don't need principle so much because they have a different relationship to other people. There's more sense of empathy, more sense of connectedness to others. A beautiful feeling people can have, or sense people have, is that why would you harm someone else? Because I'm harming myself then. They feel a oneness or a connectedness to other people, and the hurt other people feel is felt for oneself. So it's not a principle anymore. Is it a virtue? Is it a feeling then? More feeling-based, because you feel like inseparable from them, so you feel when you hurt them, you hurt yourself simultaneously. So, why would you want to do that? Or as we develop in practice, we have a consequentialist approach, which is we learn that living by the precepts, trying to live by the precepts, is a fantastic way of purifying the mind, flushing out all the places where we're kind of attached and greedy or have hate or something. And it's a great way to cultivate some of the wonderful virtues in Buddhism we want to develop. It cultivates compassion, it cultivates generosity, it cultivates wisdom, it cultivates patience, it cultivates respect, clarity of mind, all kinds of things. And so for practitioners, the precepts start having a pragmatic value. It's understood these really support the practice. I want to develop my mind and grow my mind and develop these good qualities. And this and that happens as a consequence of living by these precepts and doing them. And so a consequentialist approach can sometimes become much more significant for practitioners as they go along. And then as people go further in practice, and their mind really starts becoming free, they feel quite, kind of these qualities become quite mature in them, then sometimes this virtue base becomes much more salient, much stronger. There's just so much compassion just radiating, there's so much sense of generosity and goodness that just clear that this is what's going to do it. Of course I'm going to live by the precepts. Why wouldn't I live by the precepts? I don't have to have a reason. I don't have to have a reason. I don't have to have a principle. I don't have to have consequences. I just want to, you know, let this pour out of me because it's so strong here. And then, what's I think a little bit interesting is that once a person becomes liberated, once they are enlightened, and then once they really let go of some of the deepest attachments they have, what the Buddhist tradition says is that they can no longer, they're not capable anymore of breaking the precepts. They don't have to have a reason anymore. They're just incapable. They're incapable of stealing. They're incapable of killing, of stealing, of sexual misconduct. Actually, it's kind of disappointing for some of us, maybe. They actually say if you're fully enlightened, you're incapable of intercourse. So, you know, we don't advertise that too much. And then incapable of lying and incapable of being involved in intoxicants. That's quite a statement, quite an idea, that there's something about the deep letting go, the releasing. And I think part of the how this could be understood is that these forces of these to break the precepts generally, at least from a Buddhist point of view, you have to have some unhealthy, unwholesome motivation. You might disagree with that, but this is what the Buddhist tradition says, is that no matter what the act is of killing, it's always going to be an unhealthy, unwholesome motivation within it. Someone who's liberated is no longer capable of having unwholesome, unhealthy motivations. And therefore, they simply can't get motivated. They can't do it, is the idea here. So I suppose that for a liberated person, there's no ethical approach to worry about because they're simply not going to do these things, which is kind of nice maybe for the precepts, but I think it's a little bit too simplistic for the complicated social life we live in. I think in the time of the Buddha, they didn't vote, they didn't pay taxes, they weren't involved in all kinds of social issues that were kind of expected to be part of these days. And so in some ways it was a simpler time, a radically simpler time. And so, the ethics came down to these five precepts. But what happens if you're a doctor in a hospital, or you're a therapist, or you're a police officer, or there's all these different professions that have, when you're expected to live by certain principles and negotiate your way with them and understand them. And what about with, how are you going to vote? How do you vote for the distribution of resources in our society? And how do you make a decision there? Is that an ethical decision? Or maybe you don't want to say it's ethical, but still you have to have some basis for a decision. And how do we share the resources? And how do we live with the natural world and take care of it? And And what's the basis of those kinds of decision making? So people will have those four approaches to make that. So I think even if someone is fully liberated of unhealthy motivations, they still have to do that kind of reflection. It's called ethical reflection. And one of the ideas is that when people become ethically mature, they become ethically reflective, meaning that they're able to think in ethical terms. They're able to think these things out more carefully. They understand the different approaches, they understand the pros and cons of them, and they're articulate about it, and they know how to talk about it, and they can recognize it in other people. Say, oh, that's a consequentialist approach, and I'm coming from a virtue approach. And so that, no wonder we're not kind of seeing eye to eye. So now we can talk about that. Now we can talk about it specifically, as opposed to who's right and who's wrong. And so becoming ethically literate and reflective, I think, becomes increasingly important for us in a way that was not true 2,500 years ago, if what we want to do is to be citizens of our society and participate in it. So four approaches for the five precepts, four approaches of ethical decisions for how to live in society. One of the things you might do, if this you found this interesting, is spend some time considering, of those four approaches, which is the one you tend to go to the most. Most people use all of them in different, but they all usually have one which is the predominant one. And you might kind of start kind of tallying up or looking and seeing, where do you tend to go? Do you tend to be more principled, more consequentialist, more virtue-based, more just because it feels good or feels bad? And what is your particular... And then what's the pros and cons of these different approaches? And what's the pros of cons of your particular favorite approach? They get wiser and more... And to understand this and reflect on it will make you a much wiser person or society, much easier able to navigate through our social world around these issues, much easier to kind of find your way in conflict with people. And that's one of the best things, is to be able to work through conflict to the other side. And so we can live together in friendly, kind, supportive ways for each other, in a society of mutual benefit. So we have 5 minutes before the 9 o'clock ending. If anyone wants any comments or protests or questions about this, you're welcome. Different points of view than what I've said.
When I think about the ethical obligations that I feel as a Buddhist, I am so confused and puzzled at what I see happening in Burma, Myanmar. And I just spoke with a woman who, for the past 8 years, has run the refugee camp there. Can you shed any light on that?
I don't think I can shed much light on it, except that I think every religion in the world has had examples of people who wear the garb of the religion and follow ethics that don't seem to be the intent of the founder. But if you look at it carefully, you probably find that there are values behind that. They often think they are doing Buddhism, they are doing the ethical thing. And so what are the values that come into play there? What are they believing is important? How do they see other people, view other people? And are people... the only light I can shed is that this is a common human phenomenon that happens everywhere. If you're involved in Buddhism, it's best not to hold up Buddhism as being this pristine, pure religion that has it all just worked out and fine.
I guess my question is, do you have any awareness of what it is that they're valuing? What is it that they're thinking? Because they are Buddhists.
I think a lot of it is ethnic strife. You know, ethnic strife goes on in countries all over the world, and people kill each other for that, and genocide happens because of it. It's so I think it's just another variation of ethnic strife.
Thank you.
And you know, we've had plenty of that in this country, right? We have a whole long legacy of the same thing happening here. It's not like it only goes back a few decades where this country was involved in the same thing.
I have a question about your comment about what would you do if your family was threatened or a group of people wanted to kill your family. What would be the Buddhist response?
What would be the what?
The Buddhist response.
The Buddhist response. I don't think I care about the Buddhist response. I think Buddhism at that point, for me, would... Because I wouldn't be so principle-based in that situation. So the Buddhist response wouldn't make much difference for me. But I would, somehow I'd respond, for sure. But what I would consider, what all the factors I would consider, how I'd look at this, maybe it depends on a lot of different things. And it's so impossible to know what the actual context, of the situation might be. Is it appropriate to just die with dignity if that happens? That would be the best thing to do because nothing else is possible. I evoked my grandparents or my parents-in-law, who lost their family when they were in the concentration camps, right? And so there's sometimes situations where there seems to be no alternative. So what do you do then? And then what are the consequences of different actions you might take? And what are the consequences for my family? What are the consequences for those around me and more widely? And how do I calculate, how do I consider that in the split seconds that I have? What do I do? One of the things I like to think about in situations like always is to, in some ways, the value of being prepared so we know alternatives. We know different ways of responding, dealing. One of the sad things, many years ago someone asked me, when we used to live in Palo Alto, our group here met in Palo Alto, this woman came and said, "I'm afraid to go around Palo Alto at night, in the evening, and I'm thinking of getting a gun. And what do you think of that?" And I didn't want to be in the position of telling her my opinion about getting a gun. But what I told her was, that it's sad to choose the option of getting a gun when a person doesn't try to explore the other alternatives to a gun. There are self-defense classes they can take, for example, and other things you can learn to do, and other options. And maybe they're not 100% as good sometimes in defending yourself as a gun, but a gun isn't sometimes the safest thing either. There sometimes is, so learn alternatives, and so be prepared, and think ahead, and I think is part of this. And so learning how to be in conflict with people, learning to be wise about conflict, which is one of the things I like people to have. So you know when that situation comes, can you step forward and diffuse it? I mean, that's not the same situation, but I remember once when I was a hippie going in the Florida panhandle into a bar. And this was not a good place for a hippie to be back then. It was, went in with a friend, and the tension in the room got, I thought, uh-oh, there's going to be blood. And not going to be their blood. You know, it was really, but the person I was with was a natural born comedian. And somehow he was able to just kind of turn the whole thing upside down and around and diffused everything, and we got out of there with no blood. So that's maybe a silly example for the example you brought up. But, you know, so we practice, for example, meditation, so that we're calm enough and clear enough and wise enough so we can look at all the options in that circumstance. And maybe we choose the wisest one we can do. But if we haven't done the inner work to be calm or be centered or know ourselves well, then some of the unhealthy reactivity we might have might take precedence. So some people will, when they're not wise, will attack in unwise ways, or will run away or put their head in the sand, or, you know, there's all kinds of unhealthy things you could do. I've had friends who were held up at gunpoint, and because of their meditation, that they were able to stay calm enough that they were able to somehow, they were surprised themselves, but they were surprised by what came out of them that diffused the situation. So, you know, so they attributed it to their meditation practice. One friend of mine at the San Francisco Zen Center, he was going to a meeting up there, San Francisco, at the Zen Center, and he was across the street when someone held him up. And I think it was a knife. And while they were there happening, one of his friends kind of walked nearby and walked into the Zen Center. So after it was over and the mugging happened, my friend went to his friend and said, you know, you see me out there? You walked by? Oh, yeah, I saw you. You were talking to this guy. I thought, you know, while I was getting mugged. Well, what he did was he calmly talked to the guy and said, you know, you can have all my money, but I kind of need my driver's license. And he was able to keep his cool and have a little exchange, and they were able to come to some kind of agreement. And he was out of his money, but he kept his wallet and his driver's license. And back then, I don't know if people had credit cards so much. So was that a wise way to do it? He attributed that ability to stay calm and present and have that kind of exchange because he didn't freak out, he didn't get afraid, his meditation practice. So I don't know how to answer the question, what I would do, but are we prepared? Do we do the best we can to be prepared, or are we just going to kind of grab the gun and just and not worry about it until then? So I don't know if that's satisfying my answer, but that's the best I can now for...
Thank you.
Okay, so go forth and make ethical choices and try to be conscious about what approach you're using. What's the rationale for it? And start getting a sense of what your predominant ones are. And if once you get a sense of which of these four approaches is your predominant one, go find some people who have different predominant approaches and talk to them and find out to understand them and get to know them and see what you can learn from them. And I hope you enjoy it. Thank you.